Well, good day, wherever you may be. Welcome to this episode of Observations. We have Scott and Kirk here, along with Craig. And Kirk, before we began, you said that you received a complaint. And it's a complaint that I was anticipating. It's one of the reasons I have gone out of my way to explain why we're doing it. But the complaint was that there's some folks that are tired of us exposing and condemning Paul and would like us to just return to the basics of the covenant and God's overall message to us. Is that valid?
And anything, it's just right. People, you swim around with Paul, and I think everybody gets sick of it. And I appreciate,
I appreciate that.
But my response to something like that, at least in my own mind, I didn't really respond to the person because everyone's entitled to opinion, and theirs as good as mine. But you know, a lot of people, when it comes to Paul, he's got to be in Christianity. It's got to be, my response would be, it's got to be the most poisonous disease that's ever hit mankind.
Yes.
And then when you encompass that with, or you include that with its enabling of Islam, it's a deadly duo. And then if you really, if you really extrapolate that into what we as a Western world who are primarily Christian become a social secular humanist.
Right. It's framed the entire politic of the West is shaped on Christianity. Yeah. Particularly on Paul's 13th chapter of his letter to the Romans. It's based on submitting to one's government. And well, for example, we just passed through Memorial Day here in America. And as I would drive by all of the mega churches that were here in the greater Cincinnati area, they all had anywhere from scores to hundreds of flags.
Yeah.
And it was obvious that from the perspective of these churches, there was no difference between their religion and their politics. That
so being the church and state,
right. Or absolutely, yeah. You have the symbolism intertwined of the Christian cross and the American flag, and there's absolutely no separation between them from their perspective. So, yeah, it is more than just the religion that we have all walked away from of Christianity. It is also societal. I mean, there are very few Americans that don't do something relative to Christmas, Halloween, and Easter, even if they're not Christian.
Yeah.
You know, and it's pervasive. You look at the military and how many times we hear God bless our troops, or how you watch a sporting event and there's there's God bless America in the midst of the sporting event, or a flyby of warplanes. You know, just a funny thing. You know, when those they fly the B-2 bombers, that's the Batwing bomber, over the major sporting events. Do you know how many we have in the active fleet of B-2 bombers?
No, I'm not sure. Wouldn't know.
20.
20?
20. We spent, $100 billion or more in research. We have 20 of them.
They are one expensive plane.
Oh, my God. You know, I was out at an aircraft museum the other day, and you just look at the stupidity of the whole thing and how we continue to develop they spend god-awful amounts of money developing this technology for these weapon systems, like the F-22 is an example. It was a stealth fighter. And, we spent well over $100 billion developing it, and I don't think we even made 100 of these airplanes. And it was absurd to begin with. I mean, first, it didn't have an enemy that it could oppose. But the thing only carries its entire weapons load is six tiny little rockets, the size that, if you took a standard cup of coffee, that's how much ballistics capability, payload they carried in each one of these six missiles. I guess you could bring down an airplane with them, but you aren't doing anything else with them. Why have it?
Well, how has it helped any war
Oh, of course not. Yeah.
War that we've been in so far.
You look at everything that we've done since World War II, and you'd say, what of these weapon systems did anything of any value whatsoever? And then you can't even excuse them for World War II because of the stupidity of the way that war was waged, the great sacrifice of life, leaving the world worse off than we found it. I was outside of Dayton because this is the Wright brothers' country. And of course, the headquarters of the U.S. Air Force is at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which is in Dayton, Ohio. And as I was there, the first exhibit was the Wright brothers, but it wasn't the Wright Flyer. The Wright Flyer, of course, is in the Smithsonian on the Mall in Washington, D.C. No, it wasn't the Wright Flyer. It was the Wright second airplane.
Mm-hmm.
The second airplane was built for the U.S. Army.
Really?
And they were training uniformed U.S. Army personnel. And within 5 years of the time that they developed the first airplane, the focus was almost entirely on weaponizing it, and there was already guns being fired from airplanes within 5 years. Within 10 years, they were most airplane development was focused on military warplanes, and this had an entire wing of the museum just for the first 10 years of military development of aircraft after the first airplane was flown.
Well, there was no Hughes aircraft without the military. I mean, everything he did was. Even when he turned down their offers, he was waiting for the price to go up. You know,
what for the military?
They needed him. So
yeah, what for the military? You'd never heard of the Wright brothers?
No.
So yeah, it was pretty sad. All right, so let me explain why we're doing what we're doing, and I'm gonna do so by first asking you a question.
Okay.
Is prophecy of interest to most people?
Absolutely, it is.
Okay. My understanding is that there's three reasons that prophecy exists. The primary reason is to demonstrate that the inspiration for the words that we read in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms are from Yahweh, because Yahweh was the only person, only individual, who can consistently get precisely prescribed, predicted prophecies right 100% of the time. And so that's the primary purpose of prophecy. The secondary purpose of prophecy is that they give God an opportunity to teach.
Mm-hmm.
So every prophecy includes information that makes us wiser so that we understand more of who God is and what he's offering. And the third is so that we can be prepared, so that we can avoid the calamity that's going to ensnare many. Those are the three reasons for prophecy, right?
Yes. Very good. Yes.
Okay. All right. If that being the case, and feel free to argue. I mean, I'm stating my conclusion based on
that. I mean, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. All right. The next point I would ask you is, what is the single most prolific subject of prophecy in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms? What thing does God talk about the most?
Babylon.
No.
No?
Okay. No, not the single most. No, no. He predicts how Babylon will morph into Persia, and Persia will morph into Greece, and Greece will morph into the Empire of Rome, Imperial Rome, and how Imperial Rome will morph into the Roman Catholic Church, and how each of these beasts is devastating to humankind. And he does speak a lot about the rise and fall of Babylon, and ultimately the influence of Babylon on society. So there's a fair amount of that. And there's a fair amount of I would have thought that most people would pick as the single most prolific subject would be predictions of the Yosha.
Yeah.
And that's got to be close. But, you know, the messianic prophecies really don't exist in the sense that God doesn't use the term Messiah as a title.
No.
And so there's really, well, there are lots of predictions by way of subtle insights and dress rehearsals and perspectives on what's going to happen and how Yosha is going to fulfill these prophecies. you know, he's not mentioned by name. I mean, there's a lot of references to Yahusha and the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, but they're to Yahusha ben Nun, not Yahusha ben Yahweh.
Right.
And so, you know, there's a fair amount of it, but it's not
that,
number
that
one.
That would be my second guess is rescue plan.
Okay, and then in third, you would think that number three would be the reconciliation of Yisrael and or the final battles, the Magog War, for example, Armageddon, that sort of thing. And Armageddon, you know, the Magog War gets a fair amount of ink in one book. And in Ezekiel, it's a fairly dominant subject. But not through the rest of it. I mean, it's mentioned in the other prophets, but not heavily.
Right.
So that's not it. And, of course, Yisrael, God restoring his relationship with Yisrael is covered in a number of places, covered in Hosea, it's covered in Yirmiyah, but it's even a small part of the books where it's mentioned. So that's not it.
Hmm.
So, you know, I'm going to tell you what the single most prevalent subject is.
Put me out of my misery, okay?
Pauline Christianity.
Well,
the rise of
I can almost prove that now because of what we've covered the last year.
Yeah, we're just scratching the surface of it. The reason we got into talking about Paul again wasn't because I wanted to. I mean, listen, after I did the rewrite of Questioning Paul and took Questioning Paul from a 600-page book to 1,200 pages, after we completed the rewrite of Questioning Paul, I mean, I had my fill. That was the last place I wanted to go back.
I hear you.
But you know, I grew weary of the commercials and general attitude at Genesis Communication Network. Now we're using their facilities to record and to broadcast this program, and I'm appreciative of that. And the general manager, John Hartman, is a really fine guy, and they have one of the nicest guys I've ever come to know as their stellar employee, Scott, who is with us here.
And meet that guy.
But, you know, it got a little wearisome, and I wanted to go back to writing. And I typically, when I write, I follow a lead. Somebody will send me something, and, you know, like Questioning Paul, our good friend, to David, from the land down under in New Zealand, sent me an email, said that he'd overheard pastors in New Zealand explaining that the Torah had been nullified and that Paul claims that it had been nullified in Galatians, and that therefore it has no value whatsoever. And studying what he sent me led to the book. Well, this particular book, Observations for Our Time, which is what this program is named after, is a derivative of an email as well.
Mm-hmm.
A different individual, another individual that many of us know and have come to love, William the Elevator Man. William down in Florida, who works on elevators, asked me who the whore was that was being discussed in Proverbs 6. Simple enough question. And so I went to Proverbs 6 and started translating. Now, I want to be careful here because, I mean, I get emails every day where somebody says, could you look into this passage for me? And I don't do it 90% of the time, because once I start on a project like this, it just, you know, it sucks me in, and I just keep spend all my time pursuing it, and, you know, and if I jump around to different things and don't follow those words where they lead, then typically I get nothing done that has any value. Now, we're seven chapters into, I'm in the eighth chapter, about halfway through the eighth chapter of Observations for Our Time, and I did not know we were going to be talking about Paul again. But the 7th and 8th proverb are all Paul.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're talking about. And then as we understood then from Proverbs 6 and Proverbs 7 that it was specifically Paul that was being condemned, there was this direct association in Proverbs 7 between Paul and a whore.
Right outside the door.
Right. So I wanted to figure out what the connection was between Paul and the whore. Because Proverbs 7, that's the basis of it, is the direct relationship between Paul and the whore. And so I spent some time trying to track down what Yahweh has to say about the whore. Now, instinctively, I knew that the whore was the whore of Babylon. So if you're going to track down the whore, the book that systematically, from the opening chapter, begins by condemning religion, and then introduces the concept of the whore, and then tells us about Satan, associates Satan with the whore, and then Satan with Babylon, is the book of Yeshayah, Isaiah. You just read chapters 1 through 14, systematically take you from religion and the whore are one and the same. That the whore and Satan are one and the same, and that Babylon and Satan are coterminous. And so you put all those things together, so now you've got this ability to explain what it is that God opposes. Now, so the second answer to the question is, it's the most prolific topic and the single most interesting subject for most people. So prophecy is the single most interesting subject. It's one I happen to like the most because it proves conclusively that Yahweh authored the text that we're reading and that we can trust him. So those are, and he teaches throughout them. So it's a win-win. It's a win-win all the way through. So I really like it from that point of view, and I've used it in Yada Yah to introduce people to the reality that God can be known, that he proves his existence, that he can be known, and that what he has to say is really fascinating. And so I have a natural proclivity to go where prophecy leads, and I think the single most prevalent prophecies are on Pauline Christianity. Now, the next question I would ask you is that in Yahweh's Torah, which means teaching and guidance, is it all about establishing a list of things do not do? Is it all about establishing a list of things, these things you should do? Is it all about telling us what we need to know to have a relationship with God? Or is it also all to do with if you do these things, bad things are going to happen? Is the answer one of those or all of those?
Well, it's all of them. There's more emphasis on the latter two, I think. I don't think he says don't do this because it's not healthy for you, like kosher things. So what? I mean, that's you know better, and yes, that's easy. He's not saying you can never eat a piece of pork sandwich or something like that. And the do's, he doesn't expect us to be perfect, i.e.
No.
Therefore, that's not overwhelming his day.
No, in fact, the most important, the most common do's are listen to what I have to say and closely examine and consider what it is that I have written on your behalf. So that's the most common do, is to shed your ignorance and develop a basis of knowledge so that you can understand and therefore make responsible, reasonable decisions. God spends about as much time, if not more, talking about the things that trip us up as he does the things that are beneficial for us. And the more you understand the things that trip you up, the better you understand who God is and what he's offering. For example, if we were to mock the U.S. military and its wasteful spending on all manner of deadly contraptions, its propensity to abuse women sexually and not hold the perpetrators accountable, its a deliberate use of deception regarding its wars, and the fact that it has never done what it claims to do, which is to defend American freedom. If we were to mock the military and expose, and be, we'd be, 100 people among several hundred million that recognize that the U.S. military is counterproductive and a complete and utter waste of money and a fraud. You might say, well, why are we focused on that as opposed to God wanting us to trust and rely on Him. And I'm telling you, they're the opposite sides of the same coin. You can't rely on Yahweh until you're willing to stop relying on your military. If you think your military is providing your freedom, then God isn't.
Yeah, that's true.
And you need to compare how the military goes about alleging to provide freedom when it actually withholds freedom. How it, you know, Yahweh enriches you while providing your freedom. And it's genuine freedom that costs you nothing, that liberates you in every possible way. And you can rely on what he's offering, or your military is a complete fraud in this regard and delivers nothing of value while robbing and raping its citizenry. And so the comparison between the two is essential for us to understand. And I would ask you, the next point is, what is the first requirement for participating in the covenant?
It's always to walk away from those very things.
Correct. Now, if God just said, I want you to walk away from your country, from Babel, from Babylon, from the confusion and corruption of religion, if God said, I want you to do that, and you know that's the first requirement of the covenant, and you spend absolutely no time talking about what it is about government and religion that are poisonous and destructive and deadly,
then you missed the point.
Then aren't you taking what God said on faith?
Absolutely, because you're supposed to know what you walked away from.
Correct. And so would there be any reason for Yahweh to go through and list the 12 reasons that we ought not pledge any allegiance to or align ourselves with a government? And in Samuel, we went through this whole list of the 12 points that God made against government. Would God have revealed that if he didn't want us to know why it is that he wants us to walk away from these things?
Yeah, in retrospect, if I'd read that 20 years ago, my life would have been a lot better.
Correct. So it is essential. And if God has a requirement that says you have to walk away from your government, from Babel, from the confusion, and Babel is religion, from religion and politics, from government, you have to walk away from those things before you can engage in a relationship with him.
Right.
If we don't explain what it is about those things that is contrary to the covenant, contrary to what God is offering, why those things are counterproductive and what God is offering instead is beneficial, then all we're doing is the same thing that religion does.
Mm-hmm.
We're telling people to believe based on faith.
Yeah.
God doesn't work that way.
Not at all.
Now, the next thing I would say is this. How much time do you, Scott, and I have to learn about Yahweh and to enjoy the covenant relationship with him?
Forever.
All right. How much time do the people who are still influenced by, still sickened by, still harmed by religion and politics have to resolve that problem, to come to recognize that these things are counterproductive, to distance themselves from them and be open to what God has to say? How much time do they have?
They have anywhere from one day to 16 and a half years, I would think.
That is correct. How many people are there that are prepared and willing to tell them the truth about the things that have beguiled them, and the truth about the one who would liberate them and enrich them? How many people out there who are willing and able to do that, prepared, willing, and able?
I think it'd probably be difficult to find more than 1,000 to 2,000.
Yeah, I think in terms of willing and able and engaged in doing it, my guess is you could count them on two or three hands.
Yeah.
You know, maybe 20, maybe 30. Yeah, let's exaggerate. Let's say there's 50 people out there.
Okay.
So what if those 50 people, instead of trying to reach out to those who are not part of the covenant, decide, you know, all we're going to do is we're going to nurture and and try to enrich the lives of those in the covenant. And we're just going to spend very little time exposing and condemning the plague of death. We're just going to, help those in the covenant enjoy the relationship with Yahweh more. Now, that's a lovely thing to do.
I can do a lot of that on my own without you.
Now, I want to tell you, but one other thing here. When we talked about prophecy, I told you there was three reasons for prophecy.
Right.
If we ignore it, then we aren't providing the teaching that's associated with it, which does enrich the lives of those of us in the covenant. Sure. There are levels of confidence. The level of confidence that I had that I was reading something profound when I was able to equate the six 24-hour days of creation with 14 or 15 billion years, based upon the cosmic radiation background from the Big Bang, and then go through each of the subsequent events as God reveals them, the creation account, and realize that six 24-hour days from the point of view of someone at creation and 14 to 15 billion years looking back on from our perspective in time are exactly the same amount of time. My confidence that I was reading something profoundly important was extraordinarily high.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having spent 10 years analyzing and translating prophecies and coming to know what God said a million-fold over what I knew at that time, my confidence is far greater than it was at that time. So, even though there had been no way to rationally convince me that what I was reading was anything other than inspired by the creator of the universe back 10 years ago after, you've come upon that realization. We've come across 1,000 confirmations, every bit as profound as that since that time. And so one of the real tremendous uplifting benefits of being part of the covenant family is growing in one's conviction, growing in one's understanding, growing in one's absolute knowledge of the truth.
Yeah.
What better way to do that than prophecy?
Right. I'm totally on the same page, but I do understand that, I know if I threw down a straight stick with a whole bunch of crooked sticks, I should be able to figure out which one is the straight stick. But, the influences of, if we don't do this, rather, the influences mm-hmm. of peer pressure and all that, nobody's going to look for it.
Yeah.
The
single most devastating individual
uh-huh.
in all of human history is Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Paul, the author of the Christian religion. No one has influenced more people negatively than that one man. God has a lot to say about him, and he calls him the plague of death. He despises him.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it's appropriate for God to spend this much time talking about it, don't you think it may be wise for us?
Yeah. Maybe.
And when God said at Shavuot that what I'm revealing here is going to be, I want you to write it down because it's going to become useful in the last days.
Mm-hmm.
Who is he speaking of if he wasn't speaking of us? Right.
He's absolutely talking about.
Yeah.
And Shavuot's name is Embrace This. He's
right.
He really wants you to get
exactly.
hold of this.
Yeah. And I've been encouraged to write a book called Questioning Him, and the next line is, why don't they question him?
Question him. That's profound.
Yeah. So and when we read the prophecies that were in Proverbs 6 and 7, they were just like the prophecies in Shavuot.
Yeah.
It's not just that they mentioned Shaul by name, which is profound, because there are not a lot of Yehudim, Israelites, walking around with the name Shaul because of the negatives associated with King Shaul and the negatives associated with the name itself, which means to question him, and the negatives associated with the fact that Shaul and Sheol are written exactly the same way in Hebrew, and Sheol speaks of separation from God,
yeah.
The place that Christians know as hell. Right.